After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nichtern. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit eherenownetwork.com/David.
Shep Gordon was launched into public notoriety by the biopic Supermensch, directed by Mike Myers. He is exactly that. In Yiddish, a supermensch. In Buddhist lingo, we would call him a bodhisattva. In the last 5 to 6 years of coming to Maui to play guitar with Krishnadas at the wonderful Ram Dass retreat, Open Your Heart in Paradise, we always have a special dinner with Shep, family and friends, either at his home or restaurant here. He is the consummate host. Some of Shep's awesome CV is included herein, so suffice it to say that he is extremely well qualified as a manifestor for our CSMB podcast. He's a giant in the entertainment world as a manager, producer, and collaborator, and pretty much single-handedly created the Super Chef category and brand. His entire life is about generosity and serving others, both literally and figuratively. In my recent trip to Maui in early December 2019, Shep was gracious enough to take some time with me to chat about, you guessed it, creativity, spirituality, and making a buck.
So my guest today is the fabulous, wonderful Shep Gordon, aka Supermensch, and many people know him. And we're sitting here in at his house in Maui. And I wanted to have Shep talk to us about the creativity, spirituality, and making a buck, because he's a great person to talk about all three of those topics in one breath. So first of all, Shep, thanks for coming on.
Oh, pleasure. Good to see you again, David.
Yeah. We often have a wonderful dinner here.
Yeah. And this is maybe our, seventh, eighth year, maybe.
Yeah. I come to play with Krishnadas at the retreat here with Ram Dass, and we've hooked up together, so we usually have a wonderful dinner, which actually brings me right to one of your first passions, which is food.
Yeah.
So I want to throw a question at you, okay, which I've been asking people lately, and feel free to just answer spontaneously. But what are your three most important things in your life?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of levels of answers on a very sensory level. Food, cannabis, and beautiful weather.
Wow.
Breeze, okay. I think. But that's on a very, on a very surface level. Go deeper would really take me a little bit of time to think about. Okay.
Well, how about we go the surface level, the intermediate level, and we call it in Buddhism the outer, inner, and secret levels. So let's call that your outer level.
Yeah, so that would definitely be my outer level. I spend a lot of time, I devote a lot of time to making sure my meals are special.
Every day, kind of?
Every day. Wow. Just about one meal a day. I'm a dinner guy, but if I'm traveling, I do a lot of research about where to go. I enjoy cooking here. I love the culinary arts. I think for me, it's certainly not, again, at certain levels, but it's very much like a San Mandela, because you make it and it's done.
Ah.
And everything I've created in my life, for the most part, lasts forever.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful to make a meal and it's over.
Yes. Whew. Is cleaning up part of it?
It's not, but that's funny you should mention it, because I've had a beautiful family here in the last 5 days. Charlie Palmer, a great chef, and he has 4 sons who are in their, I would say, early 20s to late 20s. And they made Thanksgiving dinner for 25 people, and they cooked every day, and they made bread, and they cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And I have someone who comes in to clean. And I'm about to start the journey of having a child. And my last time around raising children, I had people who cleaned.
Mm.
And I said to the mother of the child-to-be, we can't have someone else clean when this baby's born.
Uh-huh.
Because the beauty of seeing this family engaged and taking care of themselves was so beautiful.
Yeah, the completion of
the completion of the whole cycle. That it was a big topic of conversation this morning.
Yeah, interesting.
Where was I? Intermediate? Is that where?
Well, we did the outer, which was.
Yeah. So I would say service is probably what brings me the most amount of joy, on a deeper level, when I can make somebody happy, or help somebody. Or do something that, you know, has some impact on somebody's life, whether it be giving them a great meal, or helping them in their career, or supporting them with a resource that they need. That, I think, for me is everything else sort of stems from that. And it took me a long time to know that and see it. And I got really lucky. I had 2 teachers. Who weren't my teachers, but they didn't know they were my teachers, who got their joy through service. And things started to make sense in my life. I never could figure out why I did things.
Mm.
And once that light bulb went on, I could really see why, why I did what I was doing.
And can you say who those teachers are?
Roger Berger, a chef.
Okay.
Who was someone I really spent a lot of time
with. He changed your life.
Who really changed my life.
Okay.
And then His Holiness, who I didn't spend a lot of time with, but spending any time with him is like spending a lot of time with anyone else.
That's His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
Yes, the Dalai Lama.
There's other holinesses floating
around. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But for me, that's...
Yeah, that's your holiness.
Yeah. And both of them, although never discussed, you could see their joy came from service.
Yeah.
And... I was in a profession where service and compassion were weaknesses rather than strengths. So I almost...
Meaning music
business? Yeah, music, entertainment business, most commerce.
Uh-huh.
I think most commerce is very male-dominated, very locker room-dominated. When you get to the higher levels of any business, it's a small fraternity of locker room guys for the most part.
Wow.
And compassion is a weakness.
Yeah,
My philosophy of business always was to have 2 winners. In most circles of higher commerce, if you don't, they're more interested in having a loser. They've won already so much; they don't need to win anymore. So their motivation is to have a winner and a loser.
Yeah. In the Buddhist paradigm, we call it the jealous god realm.
Is it?
It's one of the 6 realms. And yeah, competition and envy and power.
Yeah, exactly.
Are the kind of currency of it.
Right.
They're actually below what's called the god realm, in which pleasure and bliss are kind of the currency. You've kind of made it.
Right.
Jealous god realm is you could lose it.
You could, yeah.
So you've got to keep your eye on the prize.
I never could understand the... why sometimes I would be one of them, knowing I wasn't, but I'd make believe I was.
Mm.
And as I started to realize that I really enjoyed, I started to see that it was that I didn't have to hide it.
Mm.
But for years I hid it, you know.
So were you able to navigate
staying in that world and modulating towards a kind of more holistic or service-based
mentality? I was, because I didn't have the same goals. Uh-huh. I think if my goal was to accumulate, mm-hmm. I probably would have, it would have been a more difficult journey being of service. Mm-hmm. But my goal was to be of service. It wasn't about accumulation.
Right. Right.
So once that light bulb went on, and I gave up the thought of, why don't I have an airplane too?
Mm-hmm.
And realized, because that's not why I do what I do.
Right.
I was able to really combine the two in a comfortable way for me. I didn't have to lean on the crutches of alcohol and all that other stuff to try and get through the days. I started to have a clear vision of what I was doing.
So I think that's, kind of unusual, and it's sort of what we're hoping to deal with here in this platform, in this book, of like the idea, can you integrate those different elements, like a service mind with being potent in the world, being active in the world.
Oh, yeah.
So that's unusual, right? And, you chose two masters, one who is sort of a worldly master, one who's a spiritual master. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. And you put it together.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's extremely...
And got the one of the high points of my life was getting the two of them to meet.
Ah!
And it was so beautiful.
Wow.
His Holiness took Mr. Verger's hand and held it for probably 20 minutes. And they just looked at each other in the eye, and it was just this beautiful ballet.
Where was that?
It was in New York City at the W Hotel.
Wow.
It was an interesting evening. I was so focused on getting Mr. Verger to meet His Holiness that almost everything else was blinded me. So the way that I was able to orchestrate that so that it was a win-win situation was to do a benefit for His Holiness in New York at a very, very high ticket price with the 10 best chefs in the world, Nobu, Mr. Verger, Jean-Georges, 10 of the greatest chefs in the world, who all wanted to meet His Holiness. So for them, it was the greatest thing ever. For His Holiness, was raising money for a cause that really mattered.
Sure.
We raised a lot of money. And so in my gallop to get these two to meet, because I created the event so they would meet.
Right.
But without a selfish interest, so that everybody won.
Yeah.
And the way I presented it to all the chefs who I also managed and worked with, who were friends, was you're going to cook food that His Holiness is going to eat. And it was like, you're kidding me. Oh, my God, what should I make? And after everybody committed and the ads went out and we sold all the tickets, one night at like 3 a.m, I woke up and said, oh, my God, he doesn't eat after sunset, His Holiness. So then I was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? I can't ask him to eat. He doesn't eat after sunset. I have the 10 greatest chefs in the world all preparing dishes and coming there under the guise of him eating their food.
With other guests? Or
there were 300 people, but they didn't care about that. They cared about watching him take one form.
Sure.
That's a dream of their life. They worked their whole life for this moment. So it took me days to figure out a solution, sort of. So I went to Rinchen Darlo, who was handling His Holiness at the time, and I told him the truth. I said, I really screwed up, and these people are going to come with an intention, and I know that His Holiness doesn't want to make anybody unhappy ever, the same way we don't. Would he consider having 10 sips of broth? Would he try a spoon of broth from each one of the chefs? And they said yes. So I went back to the chefs, and I said, I completely screwed up. I'm really sorry.
But they got to put it all in the broth.
So they did it in the broth. So he had 10 spoons of broth. And we got through. Another part of the story that I love, I don't want to get dwelling on this story, but it's just so beautiful. when we get into the building at the W Hotel, the Secret Service says, where are you going? I said, I'm taking this holiness into the kitchen first to meet the chefs and say thank you, because they were really the drawers. Holiness wasn't a rock star in those days. Right. This was 88, maybe 89. Mm-hmm. And the Secret Service said, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. So we go walking, and we get to the kitchen door. And as Holiness hadn't heard the conversation, we get to the kitchen door. And as Holiness says, what's that? And I said, that's the kitchen. We go. And I said, well, Holiness says, Secret. No, we go. We went in. He got all the chefs off the line. He sat him down on a couch. He took pictures with him.
He knew.
He knew. He just knew.
There's a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, he just knew. He always knows. So anyway, I don't know how I got there. But.
Well, service, we're in the intermediate, just to catch up. We're in your intermediate three most important things. Mm-hmm. We did the outer, and this is the inner. So you've got to come up with two more. You've got two more in the inner level?
That's a really interesting question.
My teacher used to say, first thought, best thought.
Yeah, I don't really have a thought. You know, my life is sort of, I love my friends.
Right.
Every minute is so good.
You didn't mention them in the outer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can we put them in the inner?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, all my human relationships are really important. I don't know if you'd call it inner. I don't know if what drives me. I've never really spent the time to dig in. It's interesting. Right. That's why I said with the GS.
Right.
I've never really spent any time digging in.
Right.
I know that I have issues that I could definitely work on that probably answer a lot of those questions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know I have self-worth issues. I know that's probably my biggest hole. I know that my childhood was a difficult childhood. Mm-hmm. So... intimacy has always been a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really, I don't feel like I've let them intrude heavily on my life. They probably have, mm-hmm. but I haven't. I may just not be a deep guy. I really enjoy smoking a joint and having a glass of wine and watching sunset.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff there.
Well, it sounds like relationships is important to you.
Important, always difficult, but important.
Okay.
I have a lot of people in my life that I love. I have four children that I helped to raise. You can't get more important than that. But I don't think of it as. It's funny. It's an interesting question. I think of it as my life, not some inner.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my life.
Right.
Love my dog.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have lots and lots of friends.
Oh, so many friends. So I'm so blessed.
Yeah.
I live on this beautiful beach. I have the resources to eat, help my friends, take care of my family.
You might be a singularity, chef. If I think of who's sort of like got that combination of elements, it might be hard to come up with.
No, I'm really lucky. Yeah. I'm really blessed.
When I did my three, the first was joy,
mm-hmm.
sharing, and food. And those, I didn't think about this at all, because the best way to do it is just fire it out there. Uh-huh. And
did you consider those surface, or did you consider those
No,
deeper?
I didn't. I'm improvising now with the three layers, the three levels.
Yeah, exactly.
I think those were just what came to mind overall. So, yeah, it's true. Probably when you... If you think about it in terms of, what we would call practice, in the sort of Buddhist world, there is a notion of going deeper into things and maybe more introspection. But you're also going out at the same time. It's interesting. Some of the practices, you go way out and just kind of expand into the space around you without kind of worrying too much about the self holding on to it. And others, you dig deep into the kind of sense of what...
Yeah, I don't feel like I've ever dug really deep.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah. Maybe I'm scared to see what's down there. But
you wouldn't be the first person to, But just speaking as a Buddhist, the Buddhist side of me, the Buddhist teacher side of me, says that's where a lot of people, like I think I mentioned to you that I went with, you know, I had this quirky thing happen with the new book where one of my cousins has a big law firm in New York, and they just out of the blue, I was actually going to visit them for, you know, when you break the fast on Yom Kippur.
Yep.
And my cousin, who is married to the guy who's the head of this big law firm, but she's also a lawyer, she just looked at me and she said, we're having our entire international gathering coming to New York for a conference. And what I want to do is buy 445 copies of your book and give it to each person in our company and then have you come and address us.
That's fantastic.
So I just found myself, as I often do, like kind of just showing up for whatever arose. And then I was meeting with the partners in one of the meetings and staff and others. So these are obviously bright people, sharp people, you know. And the two exercises I did with them, one was just sitting for 3 minutes, basic mindfulness meditation.
Which is really difficult.
Well,
for that kind
of, my cousin, who's, you know, extremely capable, bright, and loving fellow, said the 3 minutes was hard for him.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing I did was a practice what's called deep listening, a dyad. You sit with just one person, and one person only listens while the other person speaks for 5 minutes, which is very unusual because usually we're batting the ball back and forth. And
do you give them a topic?
Yeah, you can. Yeah. And it can be anything. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of this is, a lot of the reason I wrote the book is seeing if people are in alignment with who they really are, what they really want to be doing. And like, this is the lifetime to manifest that, not like 100 years from now or something like
that. And do you think that being of service is something you're born with or something you learn? Is it an innate sense?
I believe it's innate. And I'm probably, probably would, His Holiness would probably agree, there's something we call bodhicitta, the awakened heart. And they say it's a natural, just like your actual heart is natural. Right. The quality of wanting to love and be loved and is innate in everybody. That's what Buddhists would say. But it can get covered over with traumatic events, hyperactivity of the mind, emotional blockages, all those kind of things. But I believe it's natural.
Which are all readily available in the marketplace.
in this world, they're abundant. So
I think one of one of the teaching moments, I had very few teaching moments in my life, but one of my teaching moments was going to a restaurant with Mr. Berger, and the food, I did not like the food, so I didn't eat much, and he finished his plate, and he finished my plate, and when we left the restaurant, I said to him, what did I miss, Mr. Berger? Because I didn't think that was good. And he said, oh, Shep, it was horrible. And I said, if it was horrible, why did you finish both plates? And he said, because the chef will be watching the plates when they come back to the kitchen. And I did not wake up this morning to ruin someone's day.
Mm.
Very easy for me to eat bad food.
Yeah.
And that, for me, was such a perfect teaching moment of how to go through life. And that's
that's why you call him a master, right?
Yeah.
That's somebody who's tried both approaches.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And found that one makes him happy.
Well, and that's exactly what the Dalai Lama always says, right? Yeah. He says, if you want to suffer, think of yourself, and if you want to be happy, think of others.
Exactly. No, it becomes really obvious.
Yeah. And I personally, I contemplate it a lot because I don't want to just buy into something because it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I pretty much have come to the conclusion that people have this in them.
I don't see enough people practicing it that I get convinced of it, but it seems to me common sense it should be. I think for me, my first, my dad was the kindest, gentlest man I've ever met.
Oh.
So I think for me, that's what instilled it in me, even though I didn't really think about having it in me. And I acted. I never really understood why I did things. Like, I did so many things pro bono. People would say, you're out of your mind. Like, when I started representing chefs, all my peers, But I did it all pro bono. And I never understood why. I say to the kids in the office, why am I doing this? Could someone figure out why I'm doing this? No. I thought maybe ego. I thought it could be ego. Look how cool I am. Mm-hmm. I can do this.
Yeah.
I didn't really know. I would look in the mirror and say, why exactly are you doing this? And I never, and it was really through Mr. Verger, and I started to realize that I shouldn't fight it. I should enjoy it and embrace it.
Sure.
And be thankful that that's what I do.
He was actually enacting, in that story you just told, one of the most basic Mahayana Buddhist principles there is, which is exchanging self for others. He was thinking about the other person and putting that at a higher valuation.
Always.
And, it's one thing to learn that through, like, going to be trained at a school or something like that. It's another thing, just life squeezes you into that shape. And, you know, I'm not the only person who thinks this, but you're one of the most generous people that I've ever met. And that's it's evident in every time we've ever visited, you know. So what about the other people who can't access that?
I feel really sorry for them. I don't know if that's the answer to happiness for everyone. I try, in whatever little way I can, when I see somebody who I see is in my world, in my artistic world, so I know that they'll sort of listen to me because I'm old enough now, enough experience. I try and turn on the light bulb for him by bringing him here, having him spend some time. Uh-huh. That was how I got together with Mike Myers. That's what started our journey.
With or without the prospect of working together on it?
Don't want to work with them.
Yeah. It's just about seeing a person and
connecting. Part of my rules is I don't work with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't. The ones I work with, I don't.
So you just so the ones that you work with are not part of that paradigm. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. That's really it's a very different relationship, and it would really be intruding on them.
Right.
But I there are many, but there's, I offer it all the time.
Right.
And let them know I don't have any answers to anything.
Yeah.
If they're looking for a frozen food, I'm going to be here in 2 weeks and then I'm going to be happy.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
Yeah.
But what I do is I just cook for them.
Uh-huh.
I make chicken soup.
Yeah.
I talk story. We laugh. Take them on walks on the beach.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything to say to them.
Uh-huh.
If I think they're ready for it, I'll tell them the Verger kind of story.
Right.
I think we're so lucky. Just where we get dropped out of the womb, we're so lucky. You got to share it.
Uh-huh.
If the light bulb goes off and you actually figure out, or think you figure out how to get happy through this journey, you got to try and share it, because if you don't think it's someone, I did a talk at the Culinary Institute, the graduation, and I said, you guys are so lucky. You're going to walk into these, fine dining restaurants. You're going to make a lot of money. You're going to make $100 dinners for people. And you're going to walk out your front door, and to the left and to the right are going to be homeless people.
Mm.
And you can either feed them because it's the right thing to do and out of compassion, or you can feed them because if you know they're going to break your window and steal everything from the restaurant. Uh-huh. But either way, do it.
Right.
If you do it enough times, you're going to start to feel good. And that's what I try to relay to other folks. I don't really have any. I've never had a spiritual practice but I guess in some ways what I do is a.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way, obviously there's a lot of different ways of looking at all this, but so the classical Buddhist paradigm is that part of the spiritual practice is just kind of training your own mind and sort of getting more familiar with your own emotional and mental landscape so that you're not surprised by it, it's not obstructing your operation. But a much bigger part is just how you interact with other people and other beings even.
Mm.
So that's called Mahayana, the big, that's the Dalai Lama's like huge spread.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no practice for that other than actually doing it.
Right.
You know, there's little thoughts about it, like, well, what if this comes up or what if that comes up? Mm-hmm. But they all lead towards opening, you know, outward. So I would say that is a form of practice.
Right.
Yeah. Especially if maybe at some point you go like, I don't want to, you know what I mean? That comes up, like, mm-hmm. or you want to pull back
right.
and go like, not for this person.
Right.
Then it becomes kind of a practice.
Uh-huh.
Like, are you getting?
Yeah, I've had that. I've felt that tinge. I get very. What's the word I'm looking for? I feel guilty when I do that.
When
but
you,
I do it.
When you pull back.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some of those practices are about how to work with that.
Uh-huh. And in the practice, does it say it's ever right to pull back? Do you follow an instinct?
Yeah, I mean, I think the subtler and more contemporary version of it would be, you know, it's not about creating a lack of boundaries, for example, mm-hmm. or codependence. That wouldn't be the point.
Mm-hmm.
So you could create a healthy boundary in a situation, but it's probably going to be good for the other person, too, at that point. Because, mm-hmm. You know, that might be what they need, communication-wise, mm-hmm. right? So it doesn't mean compassion is not always sickly
right.
sweet.
Right.
It's not always nice. Right. You know, it can be clear at some
mm-hmm.
points. You know, no, you should stop doing
that's,
that.
Yeah. Yeah, good thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but, if I don't help somebody, I always feel a little guilty, but I feel
yeah.
like there's a reason that's good for it. Cause,
yeah.
But that's a nice way to look at it.
Yeah. I mean, it's deep because then also, you know, there's a famous guy in the history of Buddhism, Atisha, and he had, he was practicing his compassion so fully that he wanted to have irritating people around him so he could practice his patience. Like that's kind of extreme. He's kind of famous, you know, Buddhist explorer that way. And they said that when he went to Tibet, you know, he was going up to Tibet and they asked him to come and teach there. And he was concerned because he heard the Tibetans were really kind of nice and happy people and benevolent and he wouldn't be able to practice his patience there. So he had a Bengali kid, a chaiwala, tea servant, who was an obnoxious, you know, bratty teen kid, and he said, well, I'll take him along and I'll continue to practice. So, yeah, I mean, it depends how far you want to go with it. I'm sure somebody like His Holiness probably is rarely having to frame it out that way.
All right.
Like that's been processed.
It's, yeah.
You know, yeah. It just doesn't see it that way.
Yeah. No, he's pretty.
Yeah. Right? Because if somebody comes, yeah. it's not like me, you.
Yeah. I always felt when I had very limited time around him, and I was always too nervous to speak to him.
Mm.
So all my information sort of came from watching him. And the feeling I always got with him, at least my interpretation of it, was that his eyes would always see the miracle in something
mm.
before he saw what the object was. So every object was a miracle.
Wow.
And he every time he, you know, you'd show him, I'd give him a flower, or I'd bring him his meal, or a new person would come in. You'd see this exuberance of like the miracle of life that would sort of manifest into the...
Like very fresh.
Yeah, like
everything's
miracle,
fresh.
Like a miracle.
Yeah.
At least that's what I got out of it. So that... You know, for me, that's sort of my practice. When I find myself getting in a little bit of a hole,
yeah,
where you were just talking about a compassionate way to not do something
right.
for someone,
right?
For me, I think I go back when I'm not as bright as I'd like to be.
Yeah,
I go back to that thought of let me see the miracle and everything.
Well, that's a good second inner one.
Yeah. I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
But for me, at surface.
Yeah. I don't know. That's pretty deep, actually, because you're going to a certain place to see that.
Yeah. It's almost like a... it's like putting lenses on the glasses.
Yeah.
That just makes it easier for me to be compassionate.
And seeing the miracles, a kind of freshness
yeah,
in the perception, just allow it to be new?
Yeah, just allow it how special it is.
Yeah.
You know? I walked past my plants, and when I was a young kid, if there was a brown leaf on it, I would never think to water it. Now I look at it, what a miracle. Oh, my God, it's not, it needs help.
Wow.
So I go water it.
Yeah.
Just a different way, you know.
Boy, talking about miracles, congratulations again on having a baby.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow. You are a brave guy, man. That's...
74.
Yeah.
When I get older, dude.
Well, I'm
64. Yeah, 64. I passed it by 10 years.
10 years later. Yeah. And due in May, you said, right?
Due in May.
Yeah.
Little Ben.
So let me choose a topic from the book. Let me throw a couple of topics at you. You tell me which of these stimulates some kind of thought process on your part. Success and contentment. These are chapter titles.
In terms of commerce, I don't think one has anything to do with the other.
Okay, you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I can't say one doesn't have anything to do with the other, but they're almost two different worlds to me. It was success and what's the other
word? Contentment.
And contentment. I don't see much of that. What I do see is success, crisis, and a small amount of people getting through it, and the rest don't.
And what happens to them that don't?
They just have unhappy lives, you know, miserable, complaining about everything.
Because they are frustrated that they're not getting what they thought they
would. For a million reasons, but, you know, the guy next door has a bigger car. The woman got promoted over me.
Right.
I couldn't get the building. The guy bid less than I did, and he got it.
Right.
All this external nonsense. The success, I think if they can understand that success is being happy and they can be successful, then they get through, and then it's a beautiful thing.
Because one of the things I'm trying to get at here is I kind of guess maybe change the definition of success to be success on your own terms.
Yeah, I think it's...
Which could include, you know, anything you want to include.
And then that was my interpretation. Right. When you say success, I think of monetary success.
Right.
In that context.
Right.
And so I was totally talking about monetary success.
Right.
Not human success.
Right.
So that's where the big gap is.
Right.
Monetary success and human success.
And do you find that people who've like really gone after monetary success are often... the most dissatisfied people?
Yeah, unhappy.
Wow.
Just unhappy. Can't find anything to hold on to. The race is never over. Everything's external. It's how much they have, how much they, you know.
I saw in one of your, dialogues that you had that you felt fame was like a real danger.
Yeah,
same thing. Really toxic.
Well, fame, success.
Yeah.
I mean, they're tied.
So... it's rare to find somebody who's, is it easy to find somebody who's navigated financial success rather than fame? Those two things can both sort of...
I think they're both equally as dangerous. Yeah.
And then some people have both.
Yeah, some have both.
And what about power? Should we throw power in there?
Power is really dangerous.
Yeah.
But power, I don't really understand because I haven't been around it.
Uh-huh.
But to fame and monetary success, I really understand.
Each of those three seems to have its own basis to me. I mean, you know, just the visiting that I've done in those realms.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they're separate. They're distinguishable.
Yeah. Power's really interesting because you can get power without having accomplished anything. So to me, like, it's the guard at the concert. Who's got the power to say who comes in and who doesn't, and can turn their unhappiness into a making everybody unhappy at that little tiny bit of power.
Yeah.
Or the stewardess on the airplane.
Right.
Who's got the power over you for that
little, in that situation.
That little moment who can just make you. I just went through a thing with my girlfriend at the airport that was just, you know, A guard attendant made, we'd fly all the time, made her bag didn't fit in the rack because we were in winter and she put her winter coat in it. We were coming home. So she said to the lady, I can take my coat out and I'll wear it. And she said, no, you can't.
Oh.
And I said, ma'am, she's pregnant. She has her medicine in there. You step back, mister.
Whoa.
I mean, it was power gone crazy.
Sure.
On her. So you know, power is a rough one, but success in the others,
essentially, you don't need a lot of power, depending on the situation, to be the powerful one in the situation.
Whereas success and all that, you need, there's some...
Checkpoint Charlie or something.
Exactly, there's something, right. Yeah.
Wow. How did it resolve?
We didn't have the bag, and she didn't have her medicine.
So you ended up checking the bag? And
oh, yeah. She was calling security on us and having us pulled off the plane if we fought. We didn't fight. She just had the power in that moment. And she was going to pick somebody, and it was us. And God bless her. It didn't matter. It was, you know.
Yeah, yielding. You didn't have to give up something that would have.
It took us an extra 15 minutes to get our bag, but it was just, we're speaking of power, power is very bizarre.
And unique, right? It's not necessarily always, like, for example, you could say it's based on money, but in that situation, it's clearly not.
Yeah, no. No.
And here's
I think it's based on unhappiness of many humans.
And because they're not happy with themselves.
They're not happy, yeah.
They acquire external landmarks.
They make other people unhappy. They're unhappy, and this is the way they become somebody maybe for the moment. I don't completely understand that, but I feel sorry for her. I mean, I really felt sorry for that lady.
Wow.
It's like, what pain she must be in.
Now, those three things, the power, the money, and the fame, my perception after decades in what we do, you know, the work that we're in, is that people don't get there without really a strong desire to have that. Do you agree with that?
I would say the monetary wealth, definitely.
What about fame?
Fame is some people that sneak through.
And just, it happens
in most cases. In most cases, it's manufactured.
There's a strong drive towards
it. That's what I mean it doesn't randomly happen. Right. But there are random things that happen.
By the force of the person's talent.
Yeah, a writer, an author of books. Oprah will pick a book.
That's a good point.
By someone.
Like Daniel Goleman. Do you know Danny?
No.
He wrote Emotional Intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And it was not even, he was the first guy on my podcast. It was not even his idea. He kind of developed the idea. Uh-huh. And then it just took hold. Yeah. And it's been like.
I think there's way, story. There are a way, you know.
Yeah.
There's baseball players who, you know, there's a.
Yeah,
that aren't part of a Nike system or something,
right.
Where people. But for the most part, it takes a family, as they say. So it's
Artists, though, it's interesting. I've looked at it because I produce records and stuff. Artists, I look for that thing where I know that they want the spotlight on them.
Oh yeah,
You can just feel that energy. It's like just put it.
Well, my theory in most cases, I've dealt for the most part with artists who are live performers. Which are very different than actors. It's a whole other set of problems, a whole other set of things.
Yeah.
But in the live performance world, my theory, which may be true or not true, is that it's such a journey of rejection to get to a place of being famous.
Yeah.
That you have to have something driving you so hard.
Yeah.
To be willing to take that rejection. Usually it's what I feel, you know, self-worth issues. And you have self-worth issues. You need people telling you you're great.
Right.
You get that first applause.
Yeah.
And you say, wow, if I could get that all the time and bigger, one, I'm going to be okay. But then you're headlining Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And you still have the same hole in your stomach that you had when you thought that. And that's when the trouble really starts.
It's like a drug.
It's a drug. And that's when the drinking, and that's when you start looking for crutches.
Yeah.
That to me is sort of the common thread of most great performing artists is this deep insecurity that comes out in these really bizarre ways.
Here's another, you get a feeling for the flow of this, but one thing that we talk about here is clarifying your offering. Like, what is your offering to the world? What what would you like? You like to offer your cooking and your ability to sort of handle intricate situations. I mean, there's a real repeating theme in the stories I've heard from you, which is that you get yourself into a pickle, and you got the shovel, and you're digging out this story about Alice Cooper being shot out of the cannon being a perfect example of it. It's like, you get them in the cannon, and you get them out. And that's kind of one of your offerings. Is so many stories end up like with that kind of precarious energy quality, and you're going down to the last minute.
Like the dinner for his holiness.
Exactly. And I've heard others over the years. And so when you think about a lot of people, they're not clear what their offering even is. There's just a lack of clarity. But, you know, and it's interesting that the millennial people, they use this term hyphenate. Have you heard this?
No.
So in other words, you don't say I'm a producer. You say I'm a producer, writer, cook, all with the hyphens. Yeah, yeah. And they don't want to define themselves as one of those things.
Yeah.
So what is your primary offering? And then, is that offering going to be your livelihood offering, or just something like when you cook here for your 100 friends that come over, that has nothing to do with your livelihood?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, it's very distinct. My my offering in life is a sanctuary. You know, that's what I consider this to be here.
Have you called it that?
Yeah. It's sort of my sanctuary, you know.
Wow.
I love it. Like, it's an open door policy. People come and go, and we just cook. And
I'm one of them. I mean,
yeah,
it's just, it is like open doors.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. But in my business, my focus always was that I won't make you the most amount of money. There are other people that will make you more money.
Maybe.
Yeah, in most cases, because after my first one or two artists, I never took a artist who didn't have a number one record. Because I didn't want to have to go through that thing of
startup,
figuring out if they're going to make it personally.
Right.
Can they take the heat?
Right.
So I was really lucky. I had artists that had the ability. You could see they were about to make a lot of money.
Right.
One way or the other.
But they had already gotten onto the playing field.
They were on the playing field.
Not true for Alice Cooper, right?
I started with Alice and Ann Murray. Those were my two. But after those two, then my next act was Raquel Welch. Everybody in the world knew Raquel. Then Groucho Marx. Then Blondie.
Oh, my God.
And then I started, a lot of musical acts. But they all had real careers. So what my thing was with them is, I won't make you the most money, but you won't need, no one will need to ask what your second name is. They're not going to say Teddy who, Alice who, Raquel who, Luther who.
Right.
I know how to make you famous.
Wow.
Somebody else can figure out how to make you rich.
So that's kind of, I could potentially argue with you about, I'm not sure anybody else could have made Alice Cooper as much money.
No, Alice is different.
Okay, so that's a unique.
Yeah, that's a unique.
It's a one-off. Yeah. But the ability to create recognition and fame as a enabler,
and then you get
facilitator
the money.
The
difference was that I had no interest in squeezing the dimes out,
right?
My artists never made quite as much as other artists. You go into the same building, you make less, because we didn't squeeze anyone and we overpaid everybody.
Uh-huh.
We did everything, we weren't there to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
We were there to get famous.
I mean, of all the people, Groucho Marx has to go down as one of the, like...
He was a great... We'd be in a room like this, we'd be sitting here, he'd say, is this Shep my manager, David? And you'd say, yeah, that's Shep. Funny, it doesn't look like a crook.
So he was that way all the way through.
All the way through.
Yeah. I actually quoted him in a Buddhist section of the book.
He sort of had a Buddhist streak somewhere through there.
You want to know what the quote was?
Yeah.
Impermanence. That's the title of one of the chapters.
Although he was a seraph.
Yeah.
So that was, I think in business, that was my thing.
To flip that switch. Now, I find that really interesting because that means you understand something about psychology of the people who are out there in the marketplace.
Yeah, oh, very much so. What I always tried to do was not wait for history. I would write history. That translated into things like Teddy Pendergrass was the sexiest artist in the world. Right. He only had a black audience. How do you tell white women that in your right across the street is the sexiest man in the world without being arrogant?
Yeah.
Once you tell him,
yeah,
he's not the sexiest man in the world anymore.
Right.
So for me, it was what do I want those women to hear or see? What do I want the 24-year-old secretary who's white working at the for the government to pick up the newspaper or turn on the news? What do I want her to see that's going to get her to go see Teddy Pendergrass or listen to his music? And I came up with this idea of for women-only concerts.
Wow.
And we did concerts at the Greek Theater and Radio City Music Hall for women only. It got a huge news.
Would that even be legal now?
It wasn't legal then.
It was not legal?
No. But we did. I had the record company wanted to drop Teddy for it. The lawyer resigned because I was doing it.
Wow.
And I said, you guys are crazy. If a guy comes up, we'll sell him a ticket.
Ah.
I'm just saying it's for women only.
Okay.
Guy comes up, and they say, well, you can't say that. It's a civil rights issue. It's
right.
A boom. It's a go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And, excuse me.
It's okay. We're on the internet.
Yeah.
There's no censor.
And the toughest part was figuring how to advertise it. Because if I overplayed my hand, I thought it another arrogant, So we it took weeks to figure it out. We came up with an ad. It was a stuffed teddy bear.
Right.
That said, come spend the night with me. Love, Teddy. And
so you defanged it.
We defanged it. But then at the concert, we gave out chocolate teddy bear lollipops. So I got pictures in the news of licking the lollipop.
You are fearless.
You gotta. But that's
a quality. You're kind of fearless.
Yeah, you do what you got to do and have fun.
Yeah.
And have a good time with it. And I had artists who, Teddy respected me, said, can you actually pull this off? Because everybody thinks you're wrong.
Yeah.
And I said, I got it.
Yeah.
I got this.
So your offering would be, I can make you famous.
Yeah. And also, I
professional
was,
offering.
Yeah.
That's what you did with the chefs, too. You made them famous.
That's what I did.
What? And it's clear as a bell. Now you're hearing you talk about it. It's clear as a bell.
Could you
teach somebody else how to do what you do?
I don't know if I can. I've never really tried.
Chef Junior?
I think it's. There's guys out there who do it even better than me now.
Uh-huh.
There's a guy named Scooter Braun.
Sure.
Who does it better than I ever did it. I don't know if he uses the same. If his thoughts are the same, and he's really good at making artists money.
Right.
But I watched him do Ariana Grande when that tragedy happened.
Yeah.
And he turned the tragedy into making her the biggest artist in the world. He turned the shooting at the Manchester Arena into a worldwide television show. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of...
That's brilliant management.
Yeah.
That's taking a horrible situation.
Right.
And making it a win-win for the community of Manchester. They
right.
got to go free for his artists.
Wow.
For just a brilliant... That was brilliant management.
Uh-huh.
That he did March for Our Lives.
So you know what's interesting is that leads almost to this another topic that is be fluid and adaptive. Impermanence is pervasive. And the quote, I have a quote from each, be like water, my friend, Bruce Lee. And in fact, that's where I quote Groucho Marx as saying, giving a Buddhist lecture, impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. So your stories are almost marine-like in the adaptability aspect, right?
Yeah.
Like you just, is that because you just don't lock and load ever? You're always willing to shift and change the game?
Yeah, even know. It's what it's whatever it calls for.
Yeah, but so, you don't panic as the moment comes closer. Do you panic the edge of the panic, or you just don't panic? You're having fun.
But I'm intense.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, no, I'm really intense.
Yeah.
It's warfare.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm intense. Everybody around me knows. My team is fantastic.
Right. They just support.
They got it. They
do what I'm telling you, right?
Yeah, because they got it. And I get really intense.
Right.
I mean, you have to have total control, and there has to be only one thought if you're going to pull stuff like this off.
Yeah.
Because this is complicated. a lot of this stuff has security issues. Teddy's, you know, Alice's billboard coming down.
Right.
I did an 18,000 panty drop on the Hollywood Bowl. It's got to be.
Wait a minute. 18,000 panties?
Yeah, it was great. It was
from what?
Alice had an album with packaging panties. School's out.
What?
So I got a helicopter.
A helicopter.
And we knew the guy would go to jail because it was heavily against the law. So we found someone who needed the money, and it was a good win-win. He needed.
Did they come down individual panties?
18,000. Yeah.
Individual
panties. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
They were not bundled together anyway.
18,000.
And did people like grab for one? Or
Elton John took a dozen home. He was in the second row.
Oh my God!
That was. He said that's what made him go to the big glasses and stuff. Was that show at the Hollywood Bowl, 73.
Why big glasses? What was it?
Because he saw the theatricality of Alice.
Oh.
And all he was doing was playing piano at the time. And he said, shit, I got to get sequined and get rolling here.
Right.
He came backstage after his book.
That's a good chapter title, 18,000 Panties is a good chapter title.
It was. If I thought of something to do, then I did it.
And you, as the obstacles arise going towards it, you don't panic?
No, you just get it done.
Yeah. You just get it done.
Yeah.
A lot of other people would be going, like, getting tighter and tighter as they got closer.
And you don't, you don't win every time.
So, okay.
So you got to be prepared to, and you and the artist got to be prepared to lose and then try to make the best of a bad situation.
Okay. I didn't get that sense from.
We lose.
So there was some.
You can't go out on a cliff like this,
right,
all the time.
Yeah.
And not get whacked once in a while, because this is pretty out there on the cliff.
Right.
And then you just make, I think, the canon. There's a canon story, a very famous canon story that in my life and my career. And I'll tell it very fast because it's a long story. But Alice is playing Three Rivers Stadium, Pittsburgh. First time anybody other than the Beatles is playing a baseball stadium in America. It's Alice Cooper. I want to do something special. And what would be? Shit, I'm going to shoot him out of a cannon across the stadium. So I go to Warner Brothers, who built all our props at the time. The guy who built our prop, I tell him what I want to do. He doesn't even look up at me. He's got half glasses. You know, one of those old studio guys. He said, what period canon? And I said, what period canon? He said, yeah, Revolutionary War, World War I, World War II. And I said, any canon.
But those cannons aren't big enough to put a person in it, are they?
He goes to a drawer. He takes out blueprints of different cannons that shoot people. Because it's a trick.
Okay.
So you get in. You crawl out. There's a dummy inside that's dressed like you.
Right.
The dummy shoots.
Right.
So I thought he had it.
Yeah.
He was so confident that he had six different kinds of cannons for me to pick. So I'm a young guy. I mean, 23 years old, 24. Okay. So I tell Alice, you're going to get shot out of a cannon. He said, are you kidding me? Shot out of a cannon. I said, yeah. And I made the horrible mistake of putting it in the radio ad. So I had learned on one of our first failures, which was I put him in see-through clothes, a clear plastic clothes, and called the police, said there was a naked band on stage because I wanted to get him arrested for indecent exposure.
You did want to get him arrested?
Yeah, because that would have gotten us press.
Right.
And by the time the police came, the clothes had fogged up, so they wouldn't arrest him because you couldn't see anything. So I learned you had to rehearse. That was what it taught me. So we take the cannon out. We stage the whole thing. Alice gets in the cannon. We're in Grand Rapids, Detroit. Light the fuse. Boom, big explosion. The dummy comes out 2 feet. Drops like, holy fuck. Alice is in the cannon, so he doesn't know. Had it go. I said, it's the worst thing I've ever seen. What are we going to do? So I said, you go to sleep. I got it covered. So what am I going to do? So I get to the hotel, and they had fire extinguishers that you turned upside down, and white foam came out.
Right.
So overnight, we put genitals and hair on the cannon. We made it into a penis.
So the whole cannon?
The whole cannon. So Alice shows up and I said, this is going to be the greatest thing ever.
Right.
You get on the cannon, you rub it, you masturbate it, you lick it, and this white foam, it's going to come on the first 40 or 50 rows of the audience. It's going to be the coolest thing ever.
Right.
And he said, really? Yeah. So anyway, he gets on, he's licking, he's humping, he's doing. The foam drops out. We're the only people in the audience that know anything, even have any idea what it is. It's like the whole audience is like, So now we got one more rehearsal. And we're sold out. 58,000 people, Three River Stadium, to see Alice get shot out of a cannon across the stadium. And I know it's not going to happen.
Right.
What do I do? So Alice gets to the show the next day. He said, what are we going to do? Because he really leaves it to me. He's really easy. And I said, well, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen, but I have a feeling that you might spend the night in a hospital tonight. And he said, what? And I said, yeah, just, I have a premonition that cannon might blow up tonight. And he said, you're kidding. And I said, no, just stay with me. It's going to blow up. And the ambulance is going to come. You're not going to get hurt. They're going to take you out on a stretcher. Uh-huh. We're going to make believe we're taking you to a hospital.
Right.
I got a crew here from the TV station in Pittsburgh.
Right.
I got one of the roadies dressed as a doctor. We're going to do a press conference on the corner of the hospital saying that you've been burned, and but you're cleared to do the concert, but you have to do it from a wheelchair. You can't get shot out of the cannon because it blew up. And we went and did the concert in a wheelchair. And he got rave reviews for being...
Now, this is, I think, about 50 years ago.
This is 35, 40 years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, would you do anything like that today?
I would never make the same mistake.
Yeah, no. I mean, do you have occasion to exercise this part of your...
What I learned is that you don't advertise it unless you know you can do it.
But are you still, like, there's a whole section on daring here and creativity. Mm-hmm. Are you still operating that part of your creativity?
Yeah.
You're doing wild stuff?
Yeah, that's
right.
What I do.
Right till now.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Wow.
That's what I enjoy. So.
Still?
Yeah.
The edge?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Not knowing if it's going to, you know, then having that moment where you look in the mirror and you say, I pulled that off, man. Yeah. Give yourself a high five.
How important do you think that is to just creative people to just...
I don't think important at all.
Really?
That's my core.
Artists? You don't think artists need to get to that edge?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, some do, some don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, I think, I never dealt with down the middle of the road stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I think, you know, if you're the Eagles or you're...
They're not pushing the edge.
Yeah, you know, you don't need to push
the edge. You're finding the middle.
Yeah.
And then really strengthening
it. And strengthening it. Yeah. And that, which, if you're in for the money, that's where you make the money.
It's in the middle.
It's in the middle.
Yeah.
And you know, all this edge stuff costs a lot of money.
It costs money.
Right. It's risky.
Right.
It's risky.
There's sort of
but it's fun.
I did some scoring work for TV for this woman named Linda Gottlieb, who was produced Dirty Dancing. You remember that movie?
Yeah, sure.
So Linda was a big time, you know, hotshot New York producer, and she produced a couple of TV shows that I wrote the music for. And she used to have this expression, and I bet you've heard it. It's stop polishing a turd. Have you ever heard that?
Maybe
stop
yes.
polishing dirt.
Yeah.
Putting lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, that I've heard a lot.
I came up with one. Feeding a dead pet.
Yeah,
you know, and she would just say, you know, you get to a certain point with a project, and you go, this is not happening, and you keep. Now you're invested. You reinvest, and at a certain point, you just pull the plug.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to pull the plug on one of your crazy ideas and just got, you know, this is not going to work. I got to go back to the drawing board and start fresh.
I'm sure. I mean, I can't think of one, but I'm sure 100 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's just fresh start.
Yeah. For it. Yeah. It's part of the process.
Yeah. Well, what an amazing life you've had. And it sounds to me like you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think so.
I'd call you middle-aged.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, you've been around all these... What I would call, because it says spirituality, what I would call spirituality is just working with the heart and the mind.
Mm-hmm.
People do it a lot of different ways. There's sort of formal ways. And the thing I'm concerned about is that some people go off and do that and they become experts in that, but they don't re-engage the world on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And people who engage the world on its own terms sometimes don't really sort of travel with the heart and mind journey. So I feel like that's an old paradigm to separate those two out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of curious talking. So you've been around... a lot of spiritual, quote-unquote, practitioners, the Dalai Lama being, mm-hmm. you know, a very serious, in addition to being kind of anointed at a very early age, he also practiced his asana.
Right?
He studied.
Mm-hmm.
So was there ever any pull or lure towards any of these traditions to just go like, I want to Judaism, anything? Or?
No. I'm very strongly tied to the Jewish culture.
Mm-hmm.
Really important part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish food, Jewish cooking.
Rituals, holidays?
Rituals, but not... I belong to a synagogue here.
You do?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't speak Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it. I go to services at Rosh Hashanah. I'll usually go or Yom Kippur, usually once a year.
Yeah.
I think when I found out when I heard my parents weren't going to the High Holy Day services because they couldn't afford the good tickets.
Oh.
The religion lost me completely.
Spiritual materialism.
Yeah, it lost me. Like, it was a 1 second.
Right.
I went from a kid who was excited about being bar mitzvahed to basic, fuck you.
Yeah.
And I never went back to a synagogue from that moment on. So when I got here, we didn't have a synagogue. And
The whole island.
A bunch of Jewish friends of mine said they wanted to. And we all said that we would fund this rabbi.
Yeah.
If they never charge for tickets and let everybody in. Every one of us had the same experience as a child. I guess Maui draws those kind of people.
Mm.
But one by one, we all said how irritated we were about having to buy tickets when we were growing up for the High Holy Days.
Right.
So we have a beautiful house. It's a temple here. And no charging ever.
And do you go there?
I go for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur.
Uh-huh.
But I support it financially.
Right.
But I don't feel at all. I don't feel there's no connection between me and the Jewish religion.
Yeah,
but there is the culture.
Sure.
Which I guess is somewhere in there.
Well, and were described as a Buju in one of
yeah,
the things, that's my nickname actually, Nunji Buju.
I know you're a student. My first experience with Buddhism was going to Thailand, and in the drawer was a book.
In the hotel room?
Yeah, in the hotel room. And
sure.
I remember reading it.
Yeah.
And it really struck me deeply.
Huh.
So when I came back, I had a friend of mine from college who taught Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him about it. I said, tell me about Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So he wrote me. I said, it's on my bulletin board. It's 30 years old, 30, but it's still on my bulletin board inside. And he went through about a 10-page, really beautiful explanation of Buddhism. And the last part was, and now you can forget everything I wrote because your walks on the beach every morning are the essence of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think for me, this was my finding Maui in 74 became my spiritual grounding. And my spiritual connection.
A lot of people talk about this place that way, right?
Yeah. So this for me, this is more than.
Yeah.
I've never been big on organized anything.
Yeah.
And I've always, I get crazy when I go to the Vatican, which I've been to a few times.
Yeah. That's pretty organized.
And my blood starts to boil
when
I see the homeless people outside and the amount of wealth inside.
Hi, Wookie. Mm-hmm. Well, Wookie is showing up. Might be a good opportunity to close.
Well, thank you, David. Great to see you.
Yeah, great
as
to see
always.
You too. And Chef, thank you so much
for
joining.
Thank you for coming over.
I'm sure people will be happy to.
I'm looking forward to our dinner.
All right. Well, we'll see you next week,
Dennis.
Okay.